One of the best-known writers of mythic fiction is Neil Gaiman. In his stories, the old gods haunt American highways and back roads. Children are raised by ghosts in graveyards, and things lurk behind the walls of ordinary homes. Gaiman's first adult novel in nearly a decade, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, has just come out in paperback. It's a story about being 7 years old and about how our lives are shaped and scarred by childhood experiences.
The starting point was actually inspired by a real-life event that I heard about when I was in my 40s. It was 2003, and I had a Mini, new Mini Cooper, and I talked to my dad. I said, we used to have one of those. Whatever happened to that? Why did you get rid of it? It was such a great little car. And he said, have I never told you that story? And I said, no, you never have. And he told me about a lodger, how the guy went to the casino, gambled away all of his money, and then only intended to dip into his friend's money until he made back what he'd lost, and he lost everything. And he came back in the small hours of the morning and stole our car, and drove it to the end of the lane, and killed himself. Hearing this story was so strange. I'm going, well, I was seven. I never knew any of that happened. And he said, well, of course you didn't. It haunted me.
Did your parents keep that car? Did you drive
it? No,
after
they
that?
Sold it that afternoon.
You know, one of the questions at the heart of the book is thinking about how memory works, how it is that you can not remember something that you were part of.
When I'd finished writing The Ocean at the End of the Lane, I was looking at an interview that Art Spiegelman did with Maurice Sendak. There was a line that Maurice Sendak said. He said, I remember my own childhood vividly. I knew terrible things, but I knew I mustn't let adults know I knew. It would scare them. I remember feeling like that. I remember what it was like to be a kid, to feel like you had secret knowledge, to look at these adults blundering through the world, but you knew the world was more dangerous than they did.
We should talk about the three women, the Hempstock women, Letty, the little 11-year-old girl, and her mother and grandmother, who may live in a farmhouse but turn out to be very, very far from ordinary farm women. Tell us about them.
The Hempstocks, I suppose, began for me when I was a little kid. And I'd heard that a farm down our lane was mentioned in the Doomsday Book back in about the 11th century. So I started imagining that probably the farm was the same farm that I knew. I couldn't imagine that it looked any different from 1,000 years earlier. And that the same people had lived there for 1,000 years, maybe longer. And I just loved the idea that one day I'd get to do a story that was actually set in the lane that I grew up in, and then we'd actually meet the Hempstocks. They were much more of a kind of a triple goddess than I'd been planning.
I was going to ask you, are they the Fates? Are they the triple goddess, maiden, mother, crone? And did you feel like you wrote them or invoked them?
I think they're all of those things. Young Letty Hempstock, who looks 11, but has been 11 for a very long time now, says that her duck pond is the ocean, and she came from the old country across that ocean. And her mother says that Letty can't remember the really old country, of course, because that sank. And old Mrs. Hempstock, who may or may not be able to remember the Big Bang, says that they're both wrong, and actually the really old country blew up.
Oh, that reminds me of there's this wonderful passage. I should ask you to read it. It's the part when Letty starts to sing for the first time.
Of course. The girl holding my hand said, if you ain't telling me your name, I'll bind you as a nameless thing, and you'll still be bound and tied and sealed like a polter or a shuck. She waited, but the thing said nothing. And Letty Hempstock began to say words in a language I did not know. Sometimes she was talking, and sometimes it was more like singing, in a tongue that was nothing I had ever heard. I knew the tune, though. It was a child's song, the tune to which we sang the nursery rhyme, Girls and Boys Come Out to Play. That was the tune, but her words were older words. I was certain of that. And as she sang, things happened beneath the orange sky. I have dreamed of that song, of the strange words to that simple rhyme song. In those dreams, I spoke that language too, the first language, and I had dominion over the nature of all that was real. In my dream, it was the tongue of what is, and anything spoken in it becomes real because nothing said in that language can be a lie. It is the most basic building brick of everything. In my dreams, I have used that language to heal the sick and to fly. Once I dreamed I kept a perfect little bed and breakfast by the seaside, and to everyone who came to stay with me, I would say, in that tongue, be whole. And they would become whole, not be broken people, not any longer, because I had spoken the language of shaping.
That is such a beautiful passage. And, you know, I feel like this is an old, old idea, this idea that there was an earlier, original language in which words made the world. What were you thinking about when you wrote this?
It goes back, of course, for me, to the Bible, the idea that God made the world by speaking it. In the beginning was the Word, and it's a lovely idea.
Are there other myths that you especially love that you or are taken by that you haven't taken into fiction yet?
Yes, there are a few, although also some of the myths that I love I just keep coming back to. The Norse gods just drag me back again and again. One of the oddest myth places that we don't do anything with, really, very much is early Christian myth.
What kind of early Christian myth?
There's a layer of sort of mythy stuff that grew up fairly early on. There was a gospel, one of the lost gospels, called the Gospel of the Infancy of Christ, in which we get to learn what young Jesus was like. And it's very mythic. It's not biblical Jesus at all, because young Jesus would do things like make clay statues of birds and bring them to life. And when a teacher would try to chastise him, the teacher would be struck down. And anybody who irritated boy Jesus would be either killed or turned blind, which I look at and I go, you know, there's something so strange, the idea that people were telling each other these stories. There was a craving for sort of like Superman and Superboy stories. They wanted the adventures of Jesus Christ when he was a boy. There's also the other one that I promised myself that I will go and do something with one day, and I really haven't, is the Egyptian gods. These glorious animal-headed creatures, I would love to do more with them.
What do you like about the feeling of those Egyptian gods?
It's hot, there's sand there, and they're slightly incomprehensible. They feel a little bit more like aliens. You know, the Greek gods feel like us. You read stories about what the Greek gods did and you go, okay, I get this. This is us. You read a good Egyptian god story and you go, maybe they came down from space. Why are they behaving like this? What is going on? It's odder. It's stranger. I would love to go and play in that sand pit.
Neil, is there a passage you'd choose to read at the end?
Let me do a little bit of Granny. I said, I promise, said Letty Hempstock, I won't let you be hurt. Hurt? Said a high, cracked voice. Who's hurt? What's been hurt? Why would anybody be hurt? It was old Mrs. Hempstock, her apron held between her hands, and in the hollow of the apron so many daffodils that the light reflected up from them transformed her face to gold. Letty said, something's causing trouble. She showed the old lady my shilling. My friend found himself choking on this shilling when he woke up this morning. Old Mrs. Hempstock put her apron on the kitchen table. Then she took the shilling from Letty. She squinted at it, sniffed it, rubbed at it, listened to it, or put it to her ear, at any rate, then touched it with the tip of her purple tongue. It's new, she said at last. It says 1912 on it, but it didn't exist yesterday. I looked up at old Mrs. Hempstock. How do you know? Good question, lovey. It's electron decay, mostly. You have to look at things closely to see the electrons. They're the little dinky ones that look like tiny smiles. The neutrons are the grey ones that look like frowns. The electrons were all a bit too smiley for 1912, so then I checked the sides of the letters in the old king's head, and everything was a tad too crisp and sharp. You must have very good eyesight, I told her. She gave me back the coin. Not as good as once it was, but then when you get to be my age, your eyesight won't be as sharp as it once was neither. How old is that? Letty looked at me, and I was worried that I'd said something rude. Sometimes adults didn't like to be asked their ages, and sometimes they did. Old Mrs. Hempstock went over to a cupboard and took out several colourful vases. "Old enough," she said. "I remember when the moon was made."
I love old Mrs. Hempstock. And I love it that you made one of the most powerful people in the book, maybe the most powerful person in the book, an old woman.
I wanted to put what I suppose I best describe as grandmotherly energy into the book. I remember both of my grandmothers very, very well. And grandmotherly places were the best places to be. And I wanted to try and take that feeling of welcome and that feeling of sort of sharp-eyed practicality and give all that to the Hempstocks.
Well, the world would be a better place if we had more grandmothers and if they also ran the world, as Mrs. Hempstock does. Neil, thanks so much for talking.
Oh, thank you, Anne.
Neil Gaiman is the best-selling author of American Gods and Coraline. His novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, is now out in paperback.